Over to you, Maggie.
Thank you. This is quite exciting, really. I think that the Lord gave me something to say which has really excited me, and it's been driving me mad all week, wanting to just talk about it. I think I've driven Nick up the wall, and I think I need to turn this up as well. Nope. Go for it. This is what it's like to have servants. I'm moving to Harrogate. I've got to get used to that. Not the nice bit, though. Anyway, I wonder if you can actually remember, or if you can tell me, the first ever CD single and the year it was in. Anybody going to give it a shot? Right, you've got 10 seconds. 9, 8. We've got one at the front. 7, 6, 5, 2. It's all men so far. Come on, ladies. I've lost count. 3, 2, 1. Right, go. Oh. Go for it.
I think I'm a bit shaky now.
Yep.
I thought it might be the album. It's Brothers in Arms.
Ooh, looking good.
Yeah, we're also Dire Straits, Money for Nothing.
Okay.
Bill Haley, Rock Around the Clock.
I'm going to say no to that, but the other two were right, which I think is a sign of probably a misspent youth. It is, in fact, Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms. And the year? 1985 was reported to be the world's first CD single. However, the first CD that was eligible for the UK singles chart was in 1987. And anybody know which one got to number one? I'll give you a clue. No? I don't think so. It's Whitney Houston. Does that not give it away? No, okay. It was I Want to Dance with Someone, Somebody Who Loves Me, Whitney Houston, in May 1987. And then thinking, wow, that was actually quite a long time ago. And the people who've just left, some of them weren't born when that happened. Isn't that frightening? Yeah, I find it quite scary these days when I take on a new class and I ask them their date of birth and that it's in the 1990s. That terrifies me. And really? Really? Oh my goodness me, how old am I getting? And then I was thinking, what was my first ever single that I ever bought? The first ever single. Anyone else want to tell me theirs? What did you buy?
Manfred Mann, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
and we're about 14. Is that the 5, 4, 5? That one? Yeah. I only know that. I think it was on an advert when I was little. Anybody got another one? Sorry, Pauline. Anyone got another one? Mine's worse, don't worry. Rock me, oh, classic tune. Well, mine, and I'm quite proud of this, was My Camera Never Lies by Bucks Fizz in 1982. I know. And me and my friend Susie, we used to drive our mothers mad with this. We were typical little girls, and we used to set up a show. Doesn't that word just fill you with fear? Mummy, we want to do a show. Anyway, we used to set up shows, and where we would sing My Camera Never Lies, and it used to make us laugh, because it would go, my camera, and it would really make us laugh, and we would do it over and over again. And I bought it, and it was a beautiful 7-inch vinyl. Some of you have no idea what I mean at this point. It was a round disc, a black disc, and it was beautiful. And I'd play it on the record player. I absolutely loved it. It got played so much that it got completely scratched to pieces. And it wasn't the end of the world because I just pinned the sleeve of it. The sleeve had a really cool picture on the front, and I pinned it to my bedroom wall. And I can remember years later being a teenager and hearing for the first time about CDs. And I was like incensed by this idea of CDs. And I felt they were really expensive, really unnecessary, and I loved vinyl. And I can remember turning to my friend Sarah. We were walking through a shopping bit in St Albans, which is where I grew up down south. We were walking through, and I can remember we said two things that day. First was, the first one of us to cave in and wear blue jeans owes the other one £10, because we were goths, we didn't think that was acceptable, so I lost that bet, by the way. And the second one was, I said, I will never ever buy a CD. I will stay true to vinyl for the rest of my days, because vinyl is the way forward. I loved it. I loved searching in the markets for all the old rare editions. And I just thought they were wonderful things. And I think Nick obviously thought that too, because if you've ever been in our garage, you will see the inappropriately huge vinyl collection that lives in our garage, which I keep saying would buy me a nice car, but apparently we can't get rid of it. It is huge, and Nick loves vinyl. He used to DJ, and he's got absolutely loads of it. Fast forward a number of years, and I was presented with an iPod. And I have to confess that my reaction to this iPod was bordering on ridiculous. I did not know what to do with it. I have to confess, I spent 3 weeks trying to work out how to get the music in it. I didn't know how it worked. I couldn't work it out. I couldn't work out how it got in and how it stayed in. I was completely bewildered by this thing, and it wasn't even that long ago. Totally confused by the whole thing of iPods. And eventually I got the hang of it, but I'm still not particularly good at iTunes. It confuses me because music should be on these big black discs. And that, and I can understand that because I can see it going round, and now it's in this little box and I don't know where the music lives. And it confuses me. And then coupled with trying to work out where the internet lived, that really blew my head that day. I'm really, really not very good at it. You see, changing technology is just a part of my life, and I'm often playing catch-up. I often don't fully understand. But I have to adapt. I have to learn new skills, and I've got to move forward. I can remember the day when a smart board appeared in my classroom, you know, these big interactive boards, with no manual. It just appeared one Monday morning, and my whiteboard was gone, and my whiteboard pens, and this computer thing was there. And I didn't know what to do with it. I had no choice but to learn how to turn it on and to learn how to use it, or I would not really be able to do an awful lot that day apart from, well, probably watch videos, or as Nick would say, put The Simpsons on, because I'm an RS teacher and he thinks that's all we do. It's not. So I really didn't know what to do, and I had to ask the children in my class how to use it because they were used to them in science. So I was the pupil, and I sat there whilst they went, "You have to plug this in, miss," and you have to. It was awful. But eventually I got the hang of it. You see, all technology that was once really new and really exciting and really cutting edge at some point becomes old hat. At some point, my smart board is going to be the old thing and there's going to be something new. And you've probably come across this. Your old software doesn't work anymore. Have you ever sent an email with an attached document and the person can't read it? Because it's not compatible software anymore. It just doesn't work. Or you go to use Microsoft Word and all the icons have moved. And they don't do the things they used to do in the way you used to do it. And it's really frustrating. Because we have to live in this tension. What is new now will soon become old. And then that new thing again will become old. And then that will become old. And it just goes on and on and on. But wouldn't it be great if the new thing would come once and for all and would never be outdated? Wouldn't that be so much easier? Once and for all and never outdated. Now, for me, that's a strange idea. It's not the world I live in. Everything changes. But for the followers of Jesus, that was an idea they held very, very deeply in their hearts, that there would be a time where the old would pass and the new would come and the new would stay forever. They weren't particularly thinking about technology, no. They were talking about a new age, God's kingdom. God's kingdom would come and it would reign forever. And it was their expectation and hope that the old age would pass away. There would be this one-off transition, never to be repeated. And they lived in the hope of that and the excitement of that. It informed the way they lived their lives. It informed their prayers. It was really important to them. And unlike the vinyl record, the CD, and the iPod, this new age could not be improved upon at all. Yet maybe some would resist its introduction just as much as they do resist the introduction of new technology. Some people would resist this new age because it would be uncomfortable and it would require change. Now, obviously, I've been talking about music. I've been talking about putting music into new containers as technology develops. But Jesus was talking about his new age, and he told a story that I want to look at today that spoke of new wine needing new wineskins, and it explores this theme in a bit more detail. When I was looking at the parable that's in the Gospel of Luke, it's chapter 5, I realised that it needs to be read in the context of where Jesus was at the time and what he was doing and who he was talking to. Sometimes we can just take a parable and we sort of get it just reading the parable. But there are some parables that if you don't read the whole story, it's a little bit peculiar. And what Jesus was doing before he told this story makes sense of why he told it. Our recent teaching series has focused on parables, these stories of Jesus that have a deeper meaning, that tell a deeper truth, that get us thinking, get us working out what he was really on about. a common teaching method of the time. There would be ones that floated around that people were quite used to. It's a bit like when my kids go, I say, should we read a story? And I'm hoping it'll be a brand new one. And they go, no, same old one. They want the same old story. A lot of people liked the same old stories. But Jesus told new ones or changed old ones. He was quite exciting to listen to. And we get the idea from the Bible that people travelled miles on foot to come and listen to him. He was such a good teacher. My students complain having to walk down a corridor to come to listen to me teach. His people followed him miles. He was so, so good. So what we'd like to do is to, if you've got a Bible, we're going to turn to Luke chapter 5. If you don't have one with you, the words will appear on the screen, but there are also some Bibles dotted around on the tables. Feel free to take one of those. If you don't own your own Bible, feel free to keep it and take it home, and it can become yours. There's no charge for that at all. We're going to find Luke's Gospel. I'm no good at fractions, so I'm going to say it's towards the back. Oops, sorry. And it's Luke chapter 5. Verses 27 to 39. And I'm going to read it from the NIV version. Okay. After this, Jesus went out and saw a tax collector by the name of Levi sitting at his tax booth. Follow me, Jesus said to him, and Levi got up, left everything, and followed him. Then Levi held a great banquet for Jesus at his house, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating with them. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, who belonged to their sect, complained to the disciples, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" Jesus answered them, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but those who are ill. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." They said to him, "John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking." Jesus answered, "Can you make the friends of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. In those days they will fast." He told them this parable. "No one tears a piece out of a new garment to patch an old one. If they do, they will have torn the new garment, and the patch from the new will not match the old. And people do not pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the new wine will burst the skins. The wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. So no new wine must be poured into new wineskins. And none of you, after drinking old wine, wants the new, for you say the old is better." Let's look a little bit more deeply at what's happening in this story. The guy who wrote this, Luke, had a particular purpose in mind when he wrote his gospel. He wanted to produce an orderly account of everything that happened in the life of Jesus, a very practical purpose. But he had a particular intention as well, that he wanted people to understand something about the person of Jesus and his love for people. He wanted people to understand that the gospel, the good news of Jesus, is for absolutely everyone. Jesus had a mission to seek and to save the lost. And this theme comes out time and time again in Luke's gospel. If you've never read a gospel from cover to cover, this one is lovely to read, and you really get a sense of who Jesus is and what his mission was. What we get from Luke is this idea that all are invited into what Jesus is doing, including Gentiles, non-Jews. And it's within this context, through this lens, that we should read this parable, through this idea that all are included. The theme of inclusion is really, really key to what Jesus is saying. So we know that Luke was showing Jesus came for all people, so we can see some interesting dynamics going on when we look more deeply at the story. Now, I have a bit of a habit when I read Bible stories in that I like to know what's really going on before and after, and this one starts with the words "after this." As soon as I see that in a Bible story, I think, after what? Ooh, that's a bit intriguing. Like Mark's gospel, he suddenly uses the word "immediately" all the time, and I'm always a bit thrown by these words at the beginning. I want to know why. So as soon as I read it, I thought, okay, after what? Let's find out. What has Jesus been up to? It's quite interesting. If you flick back to the beginning of chapter 5, you can find out Jesus has been quite busy. Now, whether or not it all happened on the same day, the same week, or even in the same month is by the by. Jesus has done some pretty amazing things just preceding what's happened. If we look through, we can see that he has just called the first disciples, some hard-working fishermen. Probably not the most educated of people, probably finished their education at around the age of 13. They hadn't been asked to come and learn more, to become a rabbi, to become a disciple of another rabbi, so they were fishermen. He had touched and healed a leper. Lepers considered unclean by society. They were outcasts. They were undesirable. As David said last week, they had to often live in different places outside of the community. Jesus had healed a paralytic. He had pronounced his sins forgiven, a hugely dangerous thing to do because only God can forgive sins. The sick are also considered to be outcasts because they're unclean. The judgment being, well, that person's obviously done something terribly wrong. And Jesus hadn't just gone past him and said, oh, sorry about that. He had touched him and healed him and forgiven his sins and set him free. And now Jesus is sitting in the house of a tax collector who is throwing him a banquet. Levi, distrusted, despised, hated by his fellow Jews, seen as a collaborator because he took money from the people, too much money often, and he gave it to the Romans. The Romans, the invading army, the Jews didn't like them very much. Jesus has been actively including people, and now he comes to this place, this meal with Levi, and people are absolutely shocked by what is going on. It's a bit of a challenge to us in this as well as a community of faith. Am I as inclusive as the radical Jesus in these stories is? Am I that inclusive? Do I welcome people in? Do I shy away from some people and avoid conversation? The reason I first joined the Vineyard, I was 14 years old when I moved from a church I was in before, which I loved, but I felt God just really pushed me towards the Vineyard. And the reason I joined, I was 14, I was a goth, and at school I was the only goth in my year, so I really did not fit in. And I was considered to be on the outside of things. My clothes weren't up to scratch, I was a little bit weird, and I listened to dodgy music. The Vineyard had a slogan, and it was on the back of somebody's car, and it said, "Come as you are." And that's why I went, because I could go as I was. Didn't stay that way, and it wasn't just an outward change, but God healed me on the inside from lots of my hang-ups. But I wasn't judged when I was there. It was an inclusive environment, and I grew there. I was challenged, and I grew. And in every Vineyard church I've been in, I've had the same experience. And for me, that was hugely powerful. Are we that inclusive here? Sometimes, yes. Maybe awkwardly, sometimes, no. Maybe some of us need to be a bit more aware of what's going on around us. The Pharisees then begin to question Jesus. The initial question is actually directed at his disciples, but Jesus answers it himself quite directly. The Pharisees obviously disapprove of his choice of company. They point out he's eating with sinners and undesirables. I find it interesting that it says that Levi was a tax collector and his friends who were tax collectors too, as if he could have none other. Because no one else would be his friend. Tax collectors all had to get together because no one else wanted to know them. It's about being forced into friendship there, really, isn't it? There's a bit of a look around. Yep, no one else likes us. We might as well get together and have a party. I wonder if they actually even liked each other. I wonder if they actually spoke or if it was just a case of, well, we've got to be with someone. We might as well get together here. No self-respecting rabbi or Pharisee would socialize with these people, but Jesus did. And he replied with beautiful simplicity. Beautiful simplicity. They're like, why are you doing this? And he said, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have come to call sinners to repentance. It's beautiful. It's flooring them. It's making them look harsh and judgmental, but actually just by proclaiming truth. A beautiful thing to say. Jesus has come for the sick. He is the one who heals. He is the one who changes things. His mission statement to call sinners to repentance. This is about forgiveness, just like the leper, just like the paralytic. The Pharisees are concerned with ceremonial cleanliness, but Jesus was concerned with a change to people's hearts. He was everything a good rabbi probably ought not to be. Yet people loved it because it was just the call of God on their lives. There is a new age breaking in, forgiveness at its heart. This is inclusion, not exclusion. Inner cleanliness comes from God, from forgiveness, not from doing all the right stuff. For me, this is so exciting. This is good news for the people who were there, really good news. For once, they're going, really? We can be involved? For me, this is good news because, to be honest, I think sometimes I end up spending quite a bit of time trying to fit in. I am a bit peculiar. My kids at school tell me I'm a bit peculiar quite a lot, and that's fine. But I have to sometimes try and fit into different environments, so different expectations upon me in all the different roles that I play. And it's really, really great news for those of us who know that bits of our character maybe aren't quite right, or perhaps we don't look socially acceptable in one way or another. This is good news. You are not rejected. You are not on the outside. You can come in. A couple of weeks ago, I watched Britain's Got Talent. It might have been last week. I'd like to point out this is not a regular feature of my week. Okay, but I was forced into watching this, and I got quite into it. It's actually quite good. Anyway, I was watching Britain's Got Talent, and these two people came in. There was this lad who was 17, and this girl who was 16, and she was tall and brunette and pretty, and she was lovely, and she was articulate, and she was confident, and he was not any of those things. He was shy, and he had long hair, and he looked a little bit greasy, and he was a bit of a rocker, and he looked really, really wrong. didn't bother me, but he did look a bit wrong. And they got to the stage, and they panned the audience, and you could see all the people going, and going, oh, it's going to be dreadful. Oh, it's going to be awful. Oh, I'm cringing already for how awful this is going to be. And then they were looking at the judges. And as they came out, Simon Cowell turned to someone and he said something like, oh, here we go again. Something like that. And then they talked to them a bit, and this guy didn't come across very confidently. And then they started. He had the most beautiful operatic voice I have ever heard. It was so strong and so powerful that the judges were nearly in tears. And in the end, they said to the girl, you're holding him back. That poor girl, I really felt for her. But this guy was absolutely awesome. Now, they didn't have Britain's Got Talent in Jesus' day. But people were judged and treated differently according to their suitability. And Jesus just turns all of this upside down. He just goes, nah, that's not really what it's supposed to be in the kingdom. That's not what this kingdom thing is about. The selfish, the greedy, the bitter, the worried, the anxious, the ill, the depressed, the miserable, the actually quite happy, thank you, but inside I feel a little bit dead. The, oh, no, don't worry about me, I'm fine. But at night I find it hard to sleep because I'm in debt. All of those and more are invited into what Jesus is doing. This is a message of hope for us all and for those people we were praying for at the beginning this morning who don't know Jesus. N.T. Wright explains it like this. This idea, this is the new covenant spoken of by the prophets. Forgiveness is here and it's walking down the street, and when people repent, it is theirs. Never mind if it upsets the tidy classifications of the old system, by that meaning the Pharisees and the ways that they would do their religious stuff. This is a party, and like all Jesus' parties, it is a sign of the new age. It is for those with eyes to see a miniature messianic banquet. This is absolutely controversial. We just get so desensitized to it, but reading it again, I was, oh my goodness, this is great stuff. And then they continue to question Jesus. They're not satisfied with the fact that he's just basically shown them to be harsh and judgmental. They continue going and they say, why don't your disciples fast? This bit makes me laugh. Why aren't you like everybody else? All the proper rabbis do it. All the proper disciples do it. Why don't your lot do it? Must be something wrong. They're trying to discredit him. They've discredited him because he's sitting with tax collectors. And now they're trying to discredit him because he's not religious enough. If you really were something special, Jesus, you would be obeying all the religious laws and setting a holy example. And I love how quickly Jesus deals with this. So swift. He basically says, this is not the time for fasting. The bridegroom is here. This is the time of celebration. Really quick. They're probably there going, what? What was he on about? Bridegrooms? Who's getting married? Just, you know, what's going on? And Jesus deals with it really quickly. He just says, no, we're not fasting right now because this is not the time for it. I'm here, the bridegroom, the one. I'm here. We're celebrating. Good news is walking down the street, and it's available to anyone who chooses to take it. That is so exciting. And then he develops his theme, and this is where we get to these parables. And we need to understand these parables as a development of what he's just been saying, of the conversation that he's just had. Both are very short, and both add to the meaning, to the discussion of what's taken place. The Pharisees are trying to trick Jesus, as I've already said, and so he decides to highlight the rigidity of their old ways. He starts talking about cloth, cutting out a piece of new cloth to patch an old tear. But he says you get two things if you do that. First of all, your new piece of cloth gets a hole in it, That's a bit pointless. You just ruined a new piece of cloth. And secondly, the old garment is patched. It's not right. It doesn't look new. It doesn't look good. By cutting out a new piece of cloth, you ruin the new, and you don't really help the old. Was Jesus into dressmaking in his spare time? Probably not. I don't think he was a dressmaker. But he is making a deliberate point. He has not come as a patch for the old practices of Judaism. Neither is it right to try and make bits of his kingdom teaching fit in with the practices of John or the Pharisees. He's come to bring something utterly new, and it needs to be taken as a whole. Now, there's a little word in here, or a little phrase, which is quite important. And the phrase is, will not match. And I first read that and thought it's like a fashion thing. It just will not match, but it doesn't mean that. The Greek word is symphonio, and it means to harmonize with and to be like-minded. It's about two worldviews that don't belong together, don't work together, and they cannot mix. It's not that Jesus is saying, if you put that on top of that, it won't look right. He's saying they won't work together. The old practices of Judaism and the Pharisees will not work together with what Jesus is doing. He was saying, you know, this has been great for a long time, but this is what God is doing now, and we need to go with it. And then he continues this theme of newness and carries it onto the parable of the wineskins. No one pours new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the new wine will burst the skins, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No new wine must be poured into new wineskins. And no one, after drinking old wine, wants the new, for they say the old is better. Jesus being Jesus is using an example that people would understand. Wine bottling. That's something that people had all around them. In those times, bottles are made of animal skins. Sheep, goat, ox, whatever. And they came in various sizes. And I'm told that an ox skin can hold as much as 60 gallons, which somebody told me yesterday is equivalent to 4 beer kegs. They can hold an awful lot. They could carry the glass or ceramic bottles or wooden kegs and things like that, but it was difficult. So they had these skin ones. But after time, the skin becomes brittle and it ruptures easily. And they burst if you put new wine into them, because new wine goes in and it ferments and it expands and it will burst. New skins, however, are strong and they will stretch without bursting. They've got flexibility. They're not rigid. And again, going back to N.T. Wright, he says something which I found really exciting. Try to fit Jesus's new work into the thought forms and behavior patterns of John's movement or the Pharisees' movement, and all you'll get is an explosion. If you try to pour what Jesus is doing into the rigidity of how people understood God and their relationship with God, you're going to get an explosion. And to be fair, that's what we got in the end, wasn't it? Jesus' message is very shocking. He's preaching an all-in gospel. All those people you think are outside, actually, they're inside, and I'm sat with them. His good news is for everyone. And now he gives another dimension. This is about transformation. We've got inclusion, and now we've got transformation as well. It's not about mixing ideas. It's about grasping the transformational truth of what God is doing and has done. And this thing still forms the basis of Christianity today. This is still new today. Jesus himself, the ultimate sacrifice for sin. We don't need to sacrifice animals anymore. The Pharisees were used to this system of animal sacrifice to deal with sin. And then Jesus turns up and talks about bridegrooms and feasting and bridegrooms taking away. And he's talking about his death and his life. He's talking about resurrection and what it would mean for us all. And the Pharisees are just bewildered by this man. But they don't like it because probably they know that he's right. That what he is doing is new and they need to change. Luke finishes the story with Jesus making a comment that sounds like many people I've met, and unfortunately sometimes a bit like me. No one after drinking old wine wants the new, for they say the old is better. Sometimes, especially in teaching, we love to live in a nostalgic world where it was better in the old days, where we could just stand at the front and teach and children would just drink in every word we said and their exam results would be wonderfully better. It's complete nonsense. It wasn't true at all. But we live in a nostalgic world, and sometimes I slip into that. But could you imagine still sacrificing animals now when Jesus has paid the price for your sins with his own life? Could you imagine still having to do that once a year It's just not right. But the Pharisees liked the old way better and they didn't want to lose it. Again, we can think about this in the context of our own lives. Are we still living as though the new life of the gospel never happened and isn't happening? Are we trying to patch up our old way of living, putting a bit of Jesus in and a bit of his message in, but not really willing to surrender everything? Are we holding on to things that actually we need to surrender to his mercy and his grace and let him transform us? I read something really funny the other day. It says, Jesus doesn't want to patch up your old lifestyle. He wants to give you a whole new wardrobe. So it was quite nice. He doesn't just want to patch you up. He wants to transform you. Sin, shame, old habits. Some of us are maybe still trying to play vinyl records on an MP3 player. We're trying to make two things do this and they don't work together. It's not the best way to live and it's not what God would have for us. So in this story, we can see a few things happening. Jesus reveals his good news of forgiveness and inclusion. He points out that we can't take bits of the message and try and patch it onto old bits. The new does not sit alongside the old. He tells us that some are going to be resistant to this new age, to this kingdom message, because nostalgia is a very powerful thing. There's a challenge here to ensure that we are not resistant to what God is doing in our lives and what God is doing in our church, in our community of faith. Are we prepared to make structural changes to cope with the people that God is going to bring in? It might mean some of our rotas change, some of our agendas change, some of our programs change. But we're on a mission here. We're on a mission to be new wine for new wineskins. And we've got to be willing to let God transform us. This is not a 2,000-year-old story. This is a living message. A living message that we walk out every day. I grew up as a Catholic, which I loved, and the last bit they say in the Mass is the Mass has ended, go in peace to love and serve the world. I heard that every Sunday as a child, and I still remember it, made a huge impact on my life. This is what we're called to do. For those of us here who follow Jesus, this is what we're called to do. But if you don't follow Jesus, and if you don't know him, and you want to be part of this kingdom story, if you want to be on the inside instead of being, you know, instead of feeling that you are an outcast, that you're not good enough. I spoke to a man at my school the other day, and we were just talking, and I told him that God loved him, and he said, God would never love me. I'm not good enough. I said, that's precisely why he does. Precisely why he does. If you want to be transformed to be what God has designed you to be, then we would love to introduce you to Jesus today. We would love to introduce you to Jesus and help you get to know him. And for those of us who do know Jesus, maybe we have some old attitudes that need to change. Maybe we've become a bit rigid and a bit inflexible in places. Maybe we need to say sorry. Maybe we need to step out and be new wine. Pray for the sick, stretch out a hand to the lonely, take a risk. We can let Jesus show us the root of our old habits and our old ways, and we can change. As I said, we're on a mission to be new wineskin for the new wine. Not patched up, but transformed. Not set in our ways, but willing to be challenged and guided by God. Should we stand? Let's just take a moment just to stand before God and just search our hearts and see if there is any challenge he's put on our hearts this morning. I've got a sense that there's some people here who really want to be telling people about Jesus, who you sort of feel you have the evangelist within you, but it's stepping out of your comfort zone. And I think this morning God wants to really break the power that's holding you back there and just set you free so you can speak freely of your faith. And if that's you, we'd love to pray for you. And I think there are some people here who are feeling a bit trapped in old habits. And the truth is that Jesus came to set you free from those. And I think it would be good, if that's you, to let someone pray with you, to stand alongside you and to help you talk to God about that. They won't give you advice. They won't coach you in a way that is uncomfortable. They'll just stand with you.